welcome, welcome, welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Thank you as ever to all of you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on board. Today is my privilege to introduce to you someone who I've recently come to know, as with many people on this podcast, Sarah Jane Last. Sarah is somebody who has been on an unimaginably difficult journey as a parent and as a partner or wife. And we're about to bring a light to a subject that is ultimately very difficult to talk about. Even saying this, it's difficult for me to kind of contextualise, but actually part of the conversation that we had is about being normal and about being real about the subject of grief. Sarah lost her husband to sudden adult death syndrome about 4 years ago, which she'll tell you more about on the podcast. But I hope, as she does, that this podcast brings some normality to a subject that's very difficult to talk about and really tries to take away the taboos and the stigmas that sit around it. So I hope you enjoy this and find this as informative as I did. Thank you to her for coming on, and I'll leave you to us to having a chat. Welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Today I have the privilege to introduce Sarah Jane Last. Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for coming on and joining us. Sarah is someone that I was introduced to through a friend of mine, and she's had what I think is fair to say a rather complicated journey in parenthood. And I thought that today would be a really great way of dealing with a subject that, quite frankly, is very difficult to face for a lot of people. And I'm very grateful that she's open to sharing her story and explaining what it feels like, what she's been through, and at the same time trying to normalise that for you guys and anyone that you know who's listening. So thank you very much for coming on. It's a real privilege to have you. When did you decide you were going to have children? How old were you when you decided you wanted to have children, and how did that all come about?
Well, I can remember exactly. So throughout my 20s, I used to run nightclubs and I was incredibly hedonistic and I had no interest in children whatsoever. And my mum was like, oh, you'd make a brilliant mum. And, you know, my mum's quite sort of Mary Poppins, sort of mumsy-like. And I just had absolutely no interest in kids. I was so self-centered. It's all about the party. It was all about, you know, what DJ I was going to follow and what outfit I was going to wear and all of that kind of stuff. And then I hit 30 and then I suddenly thought, oh my God, my next big birthday is 40. I really need to get my shit together. And I wasn't married. I think I had a boyfriend at the time that I was living with. You know, I'd been doing, you know, the sort of music career for about 10 years and I loved it. But I thought, I don't want to be a 45-year-old woman still running around in Ibiza. Like, that's just not a cool look type thing. And yeah, it was almost like, I think probably a week or a month after my 30th birthday, I suddenly had this laser focus. And I remember, actually, I went to my sister's barbecue and there were all of these sort of 40-year-old women moaning, saying they hated their job and they felt like their life was over. And I thought, if I don't get a grip, that's going to be me by the time I'm 40. I need to, you know, really start thinking about, you know, do I want to change career? You know, do I want to settle down? And I felt like I'd done enough partying and fun for like 10 people. So I felt like I'd fully got all of that out of my system. And that I was ready for a sort of new journey in life. So I think, yeah, that was definitely, up until that point, I had zero interest in becoming a mother.
Laser focus on enjoying your life. We were late having kids as well, later anyway, sort of mid-30s. And I think one of the things that I'm really grateful that we did was taking the time to enjoy our own lives before that. I mean, I suppose there's two ways of looking at it, right? Either you do it that way around, where you kind of have all your fun up front through your younger years and then you decide, okay, time to get serious now and sort of step into it. Or I suppose for our parents and grandparents' generation, it was almost the other way around. But I think what appealed to me about doing it this way was the fact that I didn't want to be 55 or 60 when I decided to say, okay, you can have some fun now because your kids are independent.
Well, no, I know so many people that haven't done that, and then their relationships or the children suffer because, you know, they don't want to stay in on Saturday nights and watch X Factor. They want to still go out raving and do loads of gear. And oh, man, like, really? And so, yeah, I'm very, very thankful that I got all of that out of my system. Felt like I'd done everything sort of crazy that I possibly needed to do. And then I was ready for a much sort of calmer, in, you know, better sleep by sort of 8, half 8 rather than 8:30 in the morning, which is what it used to be in my 20s.
Yeah.
So no, that definitely sort of worked for me, I think.
Yeah, cool. And then when did you meet your husband? By how organised you are, it sounds like you should have met him the following week.
Well, I pretty much did. So I remember I had a very difficult breakup. And I can remember I went and did this, it's called NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming. And actually, I think it was when I was working for Lucy. So yeah, I was, before working for Lucy, I'd had my own sort of business and I was living in London. So I somehow found myself living back with my mum in Teddington, commuting into London and working for someone else. And while I loved working for Lucy and we had so much fun, it was a bit of a sort of change when you've had your own business and then you do that.
Yeah.
I was being very sort of grumpy and, oh God, my life's rubbish and rah, rah. And I thought, I can't bear this. So I went to the bookshop on Teddington High Street and this book literally fell out of the bookshelf. And it was something called How to Change Your Life with NLP. And I started reading it and I was like, oh, this is really, really interesting. I loved it. And a lot of it was about reframing, you know. So instead of going, oh God, I've got a commute and it's awful, I started seeing my commute as 40 minutes where I could learn psychology or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I started applying a lot of the tools. And then I thought, actually, I want to go and do a course in this. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
And on the course, they got you to do this thing called a values elicitation. And all of my boyfriends previously were, are they a cool DJ? Are they a cool MC? Are they a cool music producer? And are they hot? Basically, if it wasn't one of those four, I just wouldn't even, oh, and tall. And I wouldn't even give them time of day. And that hadn't really worked out for me. So you had to do, you know, what are the values that are important to you in a partner or a man? Yeah. So we did this exercise. I remember sitting in, it was disgusting, like the Holiday Inn in Regent's Park. I mean, it was so minging with all of these other people. And then I literally met Tristan the next week. I kid you not. And he ticked every single, you know, so all of my boyfriends before that had been poor. So I had like financially solvent. I had, you know, already mature, not a man child. I had whatever I wasn't there. And he literally ticked every single Bosch. And he had a Porsche, which helped as well. and then I remember going back because the course was like every weekend or every 3 weeks on a weekend. And I said, I've met this guy. You're not going to believe, like, he ticks everything we did on this list. And yeah, and that was it. It was absolutely.
So yeah. It was a whirlwind in some respects. Well, it just sounds like it was meant to be in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was so freaky. And I also used to have a bit of a habit of never wanting to be on my own. So I'd go from relationship to relationship. And I remember when my, and I don't think I'd ever been dumped. I think this boyfriend was the first boyfriend, I don't know, about 28 to dump for me. And it was horrific. I absolutely hated it. I remember calling up all my old boyfriends to apologise for dumping them. I mean, it's so embarrassing. I was in tears going, oh, I'm so sorry I dumped you. It's so awful being dumped. I mean, what a knob cheese. And so I remember, I mean, I had a few dates and stuff, but I had a good proper 2 years of being really single because I read another book. I can't remember what, I think it was something awful, which has now been made into a film. What was it called? It's called A Breakup Because It's Broken or something like that. And it's, okay. Until you're really happy on your own and in your own company, you won't meet the right person. So I was like, right, I'm going to do that too. And yeah, so it felt like I'd done all of these sort of good steps to lead me to this amazing man who was Tristan.
Yeah. There's something in that, isn't there, in sort of finding happiness and peace with yourself first,
yeah.
Because then you're able to be yourself with somebody else completely. And that in itself is a really kind of integral part of a healthy relationship, right? Not trying to pretend to be somebody you're not, but being able to be at ease with who you are and sort of not apologetic for it.
exactly. And throughout my 20s, yeah, I mean, it was such a fun, crazy time. But yeah, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I had some lovely, lovely, I've always been very lucky and had very nice boyfriends. But yeah, it was based on, you know, sex, drugs and rock and roll, basically.
Yeah.
Or sex, drugs, rave music, yeah.
The Rolling Stones, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so how long were you together before you decided you wanted to have children?
Oh, my God. Well, this is like the most insane story. So his mum had died in December. So he wasn't in a very good state, bless him. And we met in the January. So it was almost 4 weeks after his mum had died. We started dating. I think by the third day, I pretty much moved in with him. And we were just spending every second together. And both of us were a bit sort of stuck in our jobs. We weren't really thriving. We wanted to do something different. And we were having dinner in Marylebone. And my dad called and he basically got gout. He wasn't admitting it was gout, but it was gout.
Yeah.
And he said, I really need you to come and help me run some of my businesses in France, where he lives. And he said, you and Tristan want to move out to France and come and help me run some of these businesses. So I said to Tristan, should we go and live in France? He went, yeah, let's go. And that's it. So I think in the May, so we met in the January. And it's funny because Lucy was actually here for this whole entire journey. I remember we went to Paris and me and him were texting all the time. And so they were telling me what to write and all of this kind of stuff. So she was really, you know, there at the beginning of our relationship.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we moved to Monaco in May, and I think I was pregnant by June.
Wow. Let it not be said that you don't make decisions and get on with it. I think that's the... But when you know it's right kind of thing, right?
Well, I mean, it was a total accident, to be fair. What happened was, it was obviously very hot when we moved out there. I kept on blacking out. So we went to the doctors and the doctor said, the problem is that you're exercising in the heat and you're on the pill and your body doesn't like it. So you either need to move out of the heat, stop exercising or come off the pill. Hmm. But you also got polycystic ovary syndrome. So the likelihood of you getting pregnant is really slim. So Tristan said, well, just come off the pill for a bit, be fine. Like 5 seconds later, I was like pregnant. And he was like, oh, I didn't think it would happen. And I remember when we found out it was my birthday and I was really pissed off with him because he'd got me really shit presents that he hadn't wrapped and it was like after my first birthday together. But as I realised further into our relationship, presents were just not his thing.
Yeah.
He was brilliant at so many things. Presents wasn't one of them. And we'd gone out and had loads of rosé and I was being really sick and I thought it was just because I'd had like, you know, 50 gallons of rosé. And he looked at me and said, you're pregnant. I went, I'm not pregnant. Don't be so ridiculous. And yeah, and it turned out that, yeah, I was.
He was right. Yeah, yeah.
And then he totally freaked out and had about 12 hours of, you know, just going, oh, my God, I can't do it. I can't do it. And then he called his sister who properly tore him a new one and then it was fine.
Yeah. He got over it and got used to it. I'm not sure there's ever a good time. Like the people say that, don't they? It's like when is the right time to have kids? And actually... not that that necessarily is the way you would have planned it, but at the same time, you know, there isn't a right time. There's so many, you can always put obstacles in the way to it because there's always difficulties and challenges that you don't want to face with being a parent, right?
Well, I can't imagine anyone actually sits down, especially when you're sort of 20s, I don't know, early 30s, and goes, right, shall we now have a child? What often happens, I know to my friends, as they get to late 30s, because the clock is ticking, they have to have those conversations with new boyfriend, partner, whatever it might be. But before that, I can't even imagine the stats. I mean, but I think if I was to guess, it's probably 10-15% of people that actually go, right, should we now start trying?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, it's just, it's weird, isn't it? And it does, I don't know, I think it's not, like you say, it's not premeditated for a lot of people in terms of, okay, well, I'm planning towards the age of 30 or the age of 35 or whatever. Yeah, you might have that in your brain in terms of, like, I don't want kids before a certain age or whatever. But I think, well, certainly for me, it was like we just suddenly felt right. It just sort of felt like, okay, yeah, I think I'm old enough, I'm wise enough, I'm sort of mature enough to be able to cope with having a kid. So I'm still... fun enough, I'm fit enough. There's sort of a series of circumstances that all seem to align and it just sort of drops in as a piece of the puzzle where you go, I could probably do this now. And I suppose for you guys, it sounds like that was just somebody dropped the piece of the puzzle in a bit earlier and said, here you go, right, this is, can you cope with that kind of thing? And yes, I can kind of thing. And it just takes a bit of adjusting
to. And I think I just really knew that I wanted to be with a man who was mature and grounded and financially solvent. You know, if you look at evolutionary psychology, I mean, that's basically exactly what, you know, women look for, essentially, is, you know, someone that's going to be able to look after the fold that they're going to produce in the world. And he was, you know, the first boyfriend that I'd ever had who really fitted that mold.
Yeah.
Or the crazy party animal definitely did not fit that mold.
Yeah. Well, you've got proof of concept, I suppose, in some respects, to be able to say, that won't work. This definitely could work. Yeah. Had this happened 3 years ago, we might have had a problem, but now it's a different kettle of fish, right?
Totally. And he often used to say if you'd met me before my mum died, it wouldn't have worked. You know, his mum literally got diagnosed with cancer in the January and was bed dead by the December, and I think the amount of growing up and maturing he had to do in that 12 months was absolutely epic. And so it was almost, you know, he always, bless him, used to say that I think you know, my mum has sent you to me to sort of save me. So yeah, it was just it just all felt totally right.
Yeah,
you know, and it all kind of slotted into place.
And when it does, you sort of, you know it in your gut, and it's a case of that old sort of saying of trust your gut. And actually, there's something in that. There really is, like,
well, in books, it's all that the whole Malcolm Gladwell Blink book is all about that. I think it's Blink. About the power of trusting your gut instinct.
Yeah, it's so true. So how old are your kids now?
So Indy, named after the great Indiana Jones, is
perfect.
10 and 2 months. And Ziggy, named after David Bowie, is 7. He's 8 in September.
And how are you finding, I suppose, with Indy moving towards his teenage years kind of thing? It's how are you finding that? Are they good kids?
They are absolutely obsessed with their willies. I mean, you know, Alexa, what's the biggest penis in the world? Alexa, can you live with one ball? I mean, the questions are just unbelievable. He is starting to get BO. He's got really bad blackheads on his nose. So we're using those Boar strips and exfoliating. I'm not looking forward to teenagers, all I can say.
Yeah.
But generally, they are really good boys. They're not your classic boys. They're very creative. They're very emotionally intelligent. They're very, very kind. They're not, you know, running around with a football headbutting stuff.
Yeah.
They love animals. Very metrosexual.
Very, very modern. Very modern. Yeah. And that's what they need to be these days.
Yeah.
So obviously, a few years ago, you had the unfortunate loss of Tristan.
Yeah. 4 years ago, at the end of July. Yeah.
Would you mind telling us what happened and how it all sort of came about?
Yeah, so I was just finishing off my master's. Oh, no. So we'd been in France, and Tristan was running a hedge fund, and he just raised like 5 million quid. So he was very, very stressed. He was on the phone a lot and working. And we'd sort of done a deal that when we came back, he was going to take the boys to his friend's 40th birthday. And I was going to stay at home on my own and finish my dissertation for my master's in business psychology, because I was meant to do it in France. I didn't get the time because he was having to focus on his work. So that was fine. So he took the boys off. His best friend's called Solo. You can see a bit of a Harrison Ford theme going on. But Solo's actually Indian, it's quite random. And it was his 40th birthday in a house, I think, in Derbyshire. And Tristan took the boys and sadly died in his sleep. It's called SADS, which is sudden adult death syndrome, and it's essentially cop death in adults.
Okay. And I've
never ever heard of it before. It could happen to you, to me, to the boys at any time, and they don't know what causes it, and it's absolutely hideous. I think Ziggy was 3 and Indy was 6. I don't think Ziggy realised what was going on, but I think Indy might have tried to wake him up when he was dead.
Okay.
But because they were kind of little and I wasn't there, yeah, so, I mean, just utterly, utterly horrific. So, yeah, almost 4 years ago, and his dad was here with me because they just bought a whole lot of classic cars in America through this fund. And, yeah, I mean, I'll never, ever forget that call. It was absolutely, I mean, even talking about it now makes me feel horrific. Mm. I'm fine to talk about it, but I can just, you know,
feel it inside.
Yeah, feel it inside. Yeah, and that's the moment our lives changed forever.
Yeah. Mm. And he was there with friends for his friend's 40th.
Yeah, he's got two good friends from uni, and one's called Solo, one's called Josh. They'd all gone up there. I mean, you know, poor Solo. I mean, and they were so close. I mean, you know, he used to call him all day, and Solo taught nonstop, and Tristan was quite introverted and shy. So Tristan used to just leave the phone on speaker, do all the cooking, and Solo would be like talking shit for hours at him. And like Tristan just wouldn't say anything. But obviously every year, Solo's birthday now, he'll be reminded of that absolutely horrific thing that that happened.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just, I mean, mind blowing, doesn't even do it justice. I mean, yeah, it was just crazy, absolutely crazy. Mm. And his dad, I mean, Tristan has a half sister called Tamsin, but she's a half sister, and so Tristan's dad, Tristan was his only child, and I think in the 3 years previously he'd lost his ex-wife, well, not 3 years, probably 5 years, ex-wife, mum, dad and Tristan, all in about, you know, a 4 years sprint. So yeah, I mean, he,
wow.
Very, very, very difficult.
Even just with those things, you can start to imagine with just those few little details, you can see how many people it impacts and how quickly it kicks in, and the gravity of the things you've got to come to terms with. Obviously, it's a huge event, and not that anyone would want to come to terms with that, but it's kind of just start to see the knock-ons of kind of the damage it does, and kind of how you, what you have to come to terms with, really. So where were you living at the time? Where were you when it happened?
Well, so in the house that we're still in now in Teddington. Okay. So we literally, the whole plan was we were just going to live here for a year, and then we were going to move to Brighton or Cheltenham or somewhere like that. So I'm still now stuck in this massive great big house. but it's good because it's given a lot of stability to the boys. My way of coping when it happened was to learn everything I could about grief. So I read every book, I listened to every podcast, I went to every single grief group I could find. And you know, you just presume when this stuff happens that, like AA, there'd be loads of people talking about grief in a church hall somewhere, and yeah, there's just not. There is such little help and support out there. If people die in a specific way, so let's say maybe someone dies of cancer, there's quite a lot of support for that. But in general, there is such a void of help and support for people grieving. It's just utterly heartbreaking. So I was like a sort of Inspector Clouseau detective, trying to find all of these various resources. I desperately wanted to meet other people in the same situation.
Yeah.
To understand how they coped and would it be okay, and just to find, you know, our tribe, I suppose. So I remember having Cruz very early on, which is the bereavement charity, and she said, I've never, ever met anyone, I think I was 4 months in at this time, who has done as much in terms of, you know, trying to help the boys, trying to learn about it, trying to, you know, almost intellectualise it and learn about it. That's how I sort of coped, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And did you found that help, presumably, in terms of, did you find that it just busied your brain, or did it kind of, did it give you peace?
Some didn't help. And the problem is, like, you know, this brilliant charity called Grief Encounter, but they only do North London. And lots of these companies are charities, so they only have a very small catchment area. So I would have to drive with the boys to deepest, darkest North London, for them to do some memory jar grief workshop on a Sunday morning. I mean, it was just, I mean, in a way, it gave us stuff to do and a purpose. And there was definitely some good bits from it, but I think it was more, I mean, looking back now, I was in a total state of shock, I think, for the first 18 months.
Yeah.
I don't know, I came out of shock until then, but yeah, I mean, definitely reading of the books really helped, I think. That definitely helped. There's a brilliant book by Julia Samuel called Grief Works. And it's got various sections. So if you've lost a husband or if you've lost a sibling. And she, for years, worked at Great Ormond Street. And she had to tell parents that their children were dying or about to die. And I think she was patron of Child Bereavement UK or something. She's amazing. She's done TED Talks and she's just a phenomenal human being. And I think that her book and her sort of podcasts and TED Talks were the most helpful by far.
Yeah.
Special lady.
Yeah, I think it's... it must be, when you were saying about sort of 18 months before, you know, while you were in shock, I suppose that's the body's way of sort of keeping you alive almost, really, because your reaction to that kind of news must be, it's a survival thing, right, presumably.
Well,
you know,
they say the absolute worst thing that can ever happen to someone is losing a child, and then the second worst is losing a partner. And it's, you know... I mean, the amount of crazy things that people would say to me, oh, I know how you feel. My dog died last year. And I'm like, are you absolutely fucking kidding me? Okay. Like, shut fucking
up. Not quite the same.
And you just don't realise, you know, that no one else really, you know, fills that role. You know, your mum doesn't, your dad doesn't, you know, your kids don't, your friends don't. You know, it's someone who loves you unconditionally, who's just there all the time, who is not only your life partner but your children's father, you know. So all of a sudden I'm not only dealing with my grief, and also it's very different to someone dying of old age. You know, you've got the trauma of it, you've got grief of it, you've got the logistics of the probate and how am I going to survive and how am I going to earn money, and then you've got two other humans' grief that you have to manage as well.
Yeah.
So you know, not taking away anyone's grief, because all grief is horrific, but it is a lot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you're having to manage your own grief, their grief, plus a whole load of other random family members' grief as well. Plus then got to work and earn money, plus you've got the logistics of probate and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's unbelievably hardcore is what I would...
How did you cope, like how do you like with the boys, for example? How was it with the boys, kind of what was your sort of instinct with them in terms of when it happened, kind of thing? Presumably it was protective in nature, but like, how did that manifest for you?
Yeah, I mean, it totally was. And it was very difficult because they were at different stages. I remember I had to tell Ziggy three times. He just didn't get it. And then about 3 weeks later, we were working. And I remember I'd called Winston's Wish and they say, you've got to use the word dead. You can't say he's gone or he'll be, you know, because they just won't get it. They'll think he's coming back next Tuesday.
Yeah,
and it was just, I mean, that was the most difficult thing. I mean, I don't even know how the fuck I did that. I mean, it's just horrific. But I always talk about Tristan. We talk about him every single day. Oh, Daddy loved that tune. Oh, the Smiths is on the radio. That was Daddy's favourite band. Oh, Daddy loved that. So I think because I'd spoken to all the charities and read all the books, I knew that we needed to try and keep him alive. And also the awful thing is, the ages that they are, the reality is that they won't remember him.
Yeah.
Which is another, you know, stab to the heart. But I think the thing that absolutely drives me is I don't want them to miss out any more than they already have. So that's what pushes me to work hard and to get lots of things set up in our lives so I can be there as much as possible for them, because I know that that's absolutely what they need. I mean, Indy's separation anxiety, even to this day, is very, very bad. But also, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to move from this home. So lots of the grief charities say don't make any big changes for the first, you know, year and a half, 2 years. So don't move house, don't move schools, you know, don't get a new partner, whatever it might be. So I've really, really tried to keep their lives as stable and secure and loving and constant as possible. And that's how I've kind of helped them. Indy's had quite a lot of therapy because he struggled at various times. Their schools have been useless, utterly campus. So I've had to get various clinical psychologists and specialists in to help to tell the teachers what to do or how to help them. I've been a bit like a protective mama tiger lion, essentially. And that's how what sort of drives me, I think, to look after them and try and keep our lives as normal as possible, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose that just thinking about the context of kind of supporting the kids at school and those kind of things just sort of stand out as things that you might expect a school to be able to do. But actually, when you're going through it and you're watching the result of it and think, there's not enough here, something needs to change. It's more to put on your plate, but at the same time, protectively, it's like, if it's not there at all, then the kids don't get it. So I need to find a way of doing it. So the tiger lion sounds necessary to me.
Yeah, but I'm very lucky that I'm naturally like that anyway. I've got lots of other widow friends, who I've met through various avenues, and they just don't have that ability at all. So I count myself incredibly lucky that I'm generally a fighter and a survivor, and I'm quite antagonistic because I dread to think what would have happened otherwise. And I really, the thing that I kind of want to say to people, but I don't at the same time because it's so utterly depressing, is before a massive trauma or tragedy happens, you think, oh, this person will be amazing and this will be amazing and they'll help me, and none of that is true. People generally awful and rubbish and hurt you when you're hurt even more or when you're already hurting. So you've actually got to be very, very strong and very capable, and have your sort of eyes and hands all over everything, and it is exhausting. But if you don't, there's no one else doing it for your children, essentially. I'm just lucky that that's my sort of personality type anyway. But I've seen other widows really struggle because they're just not, that's just not in their nature. And it's a real shame.
I was interested when we were talking before we came on about it'd be great to sort of get a little bit about what it was, the statistics you mentioned about school, which really blew me away. But you said that
so the stats are that one child in every class will lose a parent before the age of 10. And so India is a primary school, but it's got a separate infant school. And since I've become widowed, there's now a widow in every single year. And I've repeatedly suggested to the school that they should, they've now got four widows. The new head's only been there 2 years, and that maybe they should get some bereavement training for the staff so they know how to handle this. And it's all free, Grief Encounter, Winston's Wish will come and do it for free. And it's just unbelievable if you think, that's only in 2 years, how many widows or bereaved children might they encounter. And it's not only that, children at school struggle with so many things: divorce, anxiety, illness in the family, neurodiversity, whatever it is. And teachers, I'm probably doing a lot of them a disservice, but they don't get the adequate training. I think mental health training for teachers is half an hour. I mean, it's utterly, utterly crazy. I'm actually moving indeed to a much smaller school in September, and they've got a full-time counsellor psychotherapist, to help the children. But it's just a real, real shame, because, when you're dealing with any of those things I've mentioned, your ability to focus and concentrate on the work is minimised. So actually, if you were to put more focus into helping them with their mental health and their well-being, it would have a knock-on effect with the results, which is what most schools get measured on and care about. But most people that, and again, I'm massively generalising, but it's my experience that lots of people that go into education, especially state education, have a certain mindset, and it's just not, activated in that way, sadly. And it's not their fault. I'm a governor at the school, and there's so many forms and health and safety and tick boxes and this and that they have to do, and so many constraints. It doesn't make it very, very difficult for them. I think mental health is the number one issue in schools in the UK. And it's just absolutely crazy that there's not a bigger focus on it, and whether that's bereavement or any of the other things that I've just mentioned. Until we start
addressing that properly at an educational level, you know, we're doing our children a real disservice.
Yeah, I mean, that it's the same with all mental health across the board, right? It's the first brick that's removed from a foundation almost, isn't it? And gradually it sort of takes more and more away. And I think a lot of the time, if that repair isn't done, if you're not kind of managing someone's foundation to make sure they're mentally well and that their well-being is taken care of, then the house above it will crumble at some point. And actually, you know, you'll wonder why your school results don't work out, or you'll wonder why kids turn to, you know, difficult situations or go off on tangents that you really wish they didn't. And somebody recently said to me, as a saying that his coach once said to him, and it says, it's not about the bins. And it kind of stems back to the idea that in a relationship, you know, when you have an argument over who's putting the bins out or whatever, all he's really saying is that it's nothing to do with the bins. It's to do with all the things that led up to that, and the bins were just the camel that broke the straw that broke the back, you know. And so in that respect, it's exactly the same with kids. And actually what I'm really passionate about in the same way as it sounds you are as well, is that kids, you know, get it right early for them. And then when they become adults, they're not having to unpick all the things that, you know, our generation, our parents' generation and grandparents had no idea what to do. It's getting better. But actually, if we give them emotional intelligence and we teach them how to handle these difficult situations as best we can, then actually they're best placed to be able to do it themselves, and they'll have more self-worth, they'll be more empowered, they'll be more resilient, and all those things will just flow, right?
No, absolutely. And you know, the mental health one, you know, I'm very sort of cynical about, because I totally agree that we need to, you know, start with the kids, because, you know, I have been very, very clear and very, very explicit about what help I needed in the early days. And people just aren't able to do it. They're either not interested, they're like, I've got my own shit going on, I haven't got any extra energy to help you. I think the biggest thing that I struggle with is I've always been quite strong and capable. And when you're not, people don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with you. They're like, this is the image I have of you in my mind as a very strong, capable person. And now you're on the floor in floods of tears, you know, crawled up like a baby. And I don't know how to cope with this Sarah. This is not the Sarah I have in my mind. And, you know, it kind of drives me up the wall, all of this, you know, mental health and well-being week and this, that and the other, because the reality is, you know, and it sounds awful, you've only really got yourself. And I've had to learn that the hard way, because, you know, it's only really the therapists that I have paid that have been able to help me. There have been, you know, I can't really think. I mean, there's been a couple of lovely friends, and they can help to a level. But the idea that, you know, if you're really struggling with your mental health and you reach out, like, I never used to understand suicide before at all. I thought it was the most awful thing ever. And now I totally and utterly get it, because I'm someone who's very open. I will ask for help. I'll be incredibly explicit about what I need. And I still didn't get what I needed. So imagine if you're feeling, you know, suicidal or really, really horrible, and you watch people like me saying, this is what I need, this is the help that me and boys need, this would be most useful, and people still don't do it or give it, then they go, well, what hope have I got?
Yeah,
so I feel very confused about the whole mental health sort of charge that's going on at the moment, because my experience is people don't help. You know, I said to you earlier, you know, I've got two therapists because I'm greedy. And both of them said it's only about 20% of the entire population who are really able to help others and put their own stuff to one side and still be able to help and give to others. Most people are so self-centered or self-absorbed or unaware or uneducated or whatever it might be, that they just can't offer help to others. And if you think about that, you know, 20% is really quite a small percentage.
Yeah.
And as you said, going back to the kids, you know, one of the main things that I drill into my boys is, you know, kindness. Always be kind. You never know what someone's going through. They've got so many friends who are autistic or ADHD or whatever that might be. So they really, from a young age, are understanding that people process and understand the world in different ways. And my hope is, you know, and they're already, you know, seem to be very emotionally intelligent, that that will carry on. And I think for men, absolutely, you know, key and critical. Forward.
Well, kind of without it, like, it's, you know, as you say, there's, you know, for generations past, we're working backwards, aren't we, really? You're trying to change people's behaviours and change people's attitudes. And fundamentally, I think when you look at subjects like racism and sexism and misogyny and all those kind of things, they don't get changed overnight. Sad thing is, they get changed when people die, basically, and the next generation come along and say, it's okay, we've got a new view on it. Yeah. And Dead Man's Shoes says that's not how we do things anymore. And, you know, work to some extent is no different to that. You know, like the state of well-being in the workplace is it's a modern thing. And, you know, we find that with Born Human, there are some businesses that are open to what we're doing. There are other businesses that are so antiquated and old-fashioned that they're not interested. It's not their style.
I know.
But there's no point in trying to convince them, you know?
Yeah. And you know, I mean, that is one of the most heartbreaking things. I mean, I do a lot of work for myself. I do some work for other people. And I would say that nearly every single organisation I work with more or less shares the same set of issues. And you just think, oh, my goodness. I mean, in order for all of this to change, something absolutely monumental needs to happen. And you would have thought that a global pandemic like COVID might have kicked them into touch. But yeah, it would seem, you know, a few of them have seen the light. But sadly, you know, lots haven't. And it's difficult. And I think you're right that actually the main way to change it is focusing on, you know, the early minds and really instilling in them, you know, a different set of values, different mindset, different way of approaching things. Because I know from when we assess leaders, all of that stuff is formed pretty much by the time you reach teenage. You know, all of your character really is formed sort of secondary school and university. And obviously you'll know from attachment theory, you know, the first 7 years are absolutely critical. So that's where we should be putting, you know, so much effort and energy if we really want to change the world, essentially.
Yeah. How do you find your relationship with sort of friends and family changed as a result of it all? Like, obviously, you said it was difficult in terms of support. But
yeah, so I joined this group called Widowed and Young Early Doors. And I remember everyone putting these things like, it's not the person who's died that is causing me the most pain. It's the people who are still living. And I didn't really understand it. I was like, what are they going on about? And I so get it now. I mean, that it's really funny. I think in all my therapy sessions, the amount of times I'd actually talk about Tristan, probably 10%, 20%. You know, I'm quite a realist. It's happened. There's nothing I can do about it. I can't bring him back. It's utterly shit. But it is what it is. And that, without a doubt, is the absolutely hardest thing to deal with. How your friends and family change, treat you differently, don't offer the support that you thought they were going to. I mean, if someone had told me this is how that they would behave and react before this happened, I just wouldn't have believed them in a million years of Sunday. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, what was it? And I won't say who, but it was a first tier family member, 3 months in. If you carry on being so miserable, no one will want to come and see you and help you, was one comment.
Wow.
Another comment, as I called them in tears on a Saturday night, well, it's your own fault you're so lonely. If you don't get out there and meet someone new, what do you expect?
Wow.
So you're in so much pain, and then you've got people who you think would be there for you, whatever, saying comments like that. I mean, oh, my God. I mean, just unbelievable. So, yeah, that without a shadow of the doubt, not helping the kids with their grief, not trying to do all the other bits and bobs, not dealing with the fact. I mean, I was having a laugh with a friend yesterday about... I've got quite a dark sense of humour, but when Tristan was to be cremated, they said, like, what outfit do you want him to wear? And I was like, doesn't fucking matter. He's going to be burned. Just like, put him in there naked. And like, I remember my friend in the funeral parlour, like, crying her eyes out, like, oh, God, this is so awful. And I was just like, I'm not going to waste like a good like suit that's going to be like, you know, burned. So none of that stuff even touches the surface to how your, you know, family and friends, how you thought that they would behave and how they don't, basically. Yeah. And I tried every single strategy in the book, you know, from being very sort of weak and needy and vulnerable to being very direct and very clear, to doing stuff face to face, to doing it on email, to doing it on text, to asking friends to tell them what I might need in terms of help and support. And yeah, none of it worked.
None of it worked. So ultimately you can come to the conclusion that you look after yourself and that's kind of how it needs to be.
Exactly. And I have a very, very small circle of friends who get it, who are utterly amazing, and I cling on to them for dear life, and I would literally walk on hot coals or go and murder someone for them, because I am eternally grateful for the help and support that they've given me and the boys over the year, but I can count them on one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange how those sorts of situations, obviously having never been through anything on that with that gravity, but you, when you do find adversity and you do see people's true colours, don't you? And actually...
Oh, totally.
It just adds to the pain of like, well, how can you not see that I need something different right now when you're as explicit as you can be with it?
Well, and that's what I was saying about the whole mental health thing. And while I struggle when I see all this stuff on Facebook and Instagram, I'm just like, it's bullshit. It's just not, you know, we need a different approach. This is nonsense.
Mm.
And yeah, it's just, yeah, that without a shadow of a doubt has been the absolute, hardest thing to get my head around. But I am hard as nails now. There is nothing, well, maybe a few things, that life cannot throw at me that I wouldn't like be pew, pew, pew. But yeah, it's been a very long and ongoing process. And I would say, yeah, definitely therapists. And I would say, and obviously I'm biased, but... clinical psychologists I have found to be the most helpful by far, because they're trained in lots of different modalities and I've needed different things at different times. Sometimes I've needed something more informational and intellectual, sometimes I've just needed to be listened to, sometimes I've needed strategies, what understanding of why other people are doing different things. So I generally find that because they have multiple points of training rather than just let's say psychodynamic or psychoanalytical, they could offer me a greater, you know, tool bag to get through it with. But that was invaluable, I would say. Absolutely invaluable.
Yeah, I suppose it sounds like, I mean, you're lucky in some respects, lucky to be able to have that information and have that inquisitive mind that kind of encourages you to self-reflect and to know what you feel you need and what you want from people, which it sounds like it's been a huge asset to you in terms of being able to find a way to cope. But I suppose for other people, it sounds like listening to, and again comes back to trust in your gut that we said earlier, kind of thing of like what it feels like you need is to go and seek that out and find it at that time. And if clinical psychologists sound like they've got more tools in their bag, then it sounds like they might be the right route for quite a lot of people to start.
And the awful thing is that, you know, lay people don't understand the difference between a counsellor and a psychiatrist. You know, the psychiatrist is just going to give you pills pretty much and not a lot else. And, you know, generally, and again, it's a massive generalisation, but counsellors tend to be a lot more passive and say, you know, not a lot and let you speak. And some people really need that and that's all they need. But I just needed something different. But, yeah, one of my lovely friends, Jo, she, I don't know if you remember, it was all over the news, a family went out on a boat in Cornwall. And I think the four kids and the mum or the dad died and only one parent survived. It was absolutely horrific. And she'd been their therapist because they happened to be kids at the school that they were all at. And she recommended her. And again, so I would say pick a therapist that is experienced in grief and bereavement, because, you know, lots of them might have a little bit of experience in that, but not a lot. Just utterly, utterly invaluable. And in the early days, I'd see her once a week and then I'd sort of go to once a month. And now I just, when I'm having a shocker, I'll just call her up and go, come on, can I speak to you on Monday? And all of that kind of stuff. So I definitely, you know, saw her a lot at the beginning and then But what's great as well is having that ongoing relationship with someone. They know all the different people in your family. You don't have to start from scratch each time. Yeah. They give you enough time to see your patterns of how you deal with stuff and how you behave. But the problem is it's expensive as well, and lots of people can't afford it. You know?
Yeah, that's the challenge, right? It's kind of, I mean, it's a difficult one, because I think with kind of mental health and well-being and kind of looking after yourself, it's partly perception, it's financial perception, and you're absolutely right, there are lots of people out there who can't afford it. But I think actually, say, you know, counselling to me was a dirty word until I was kind of 30 or so. It was just like, I don't need that. I definitely don't need that stuff. You know, that's for crazy people, not for me. Then I realised I could do with some, and I tentatively went into it. And then what I realised was that after a while, once I'd got over that initial bridge of like, okay, I'm paying someone to talk to them and there's value in that, and I start to see the value come back, then that value feels like a really worthwhile way of spending money. And obviously that's, you know, I'm fortunate enough that to be able to spend money on it and commit a percentage of what I earn to that.
I mean, I'd have it like twice a week if I could. I mean, yeah. Honestly, I just love it. You know, it's so rare that someone will intently listen to you and your story without any judgment, you know, and I do it, you know, with my friends. You know, you really don't want to be biased and you don't want to be judgmental, but it's just almost impossible not to be. And I just think it's you know, that's the unique gift that therapists of all kind can give people. But yeah, it's obviously not openly available to everyone, which is, you know, a real shame. I mean, the awful thing is, I remember going to my GP. I mean, they just give you no help whatsoever. He tried to give me lorazepam and diazepam, and thank God I didn't take that, because I probably have a drug habit that I'd be trying to kick at the same time. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Actually, you know, when this stuff happens, there is honestly so little support, and I had to go and seek it, find it, and I was just lucky that was my way of coping. But it really is a tragedy that there's not a better infrastructure. You know, what I would love to see is, just like you have AA or NA meetings, you would have Grief Anonymous.
Yeah.
Rock up to any hall or any Zoom, you know, because AA is what, a million times a day you can
see
many different groups. And I think that is the model that, you know, would help so many people, because, you know, so many people are grieving in so many ways. It could be miscarriage. It could be, you know, someone who's actually died. I mean, I think divorce, I mean, so many of my friends are getting divorced, and I'm a child of divorced parents. And I remember I was, you know, when I was doing my psychology degree, because I'm a child of divorce, I would structure a lot of my essays around it. And in a way, I think it can be worse on the children than death. Mm-hmm. And the research actually backs that up, because it's constant. If it's a toxic divorce, it is never, ever, ever ending. You know, with my boys, they had one massive trauma and we're slowly healing from it. Mm-hmm. You know, with divorce, you have a massive trauma, and then every week or every couple of weeks, your mum and dad have a massive barney, or the dad says, I'm not having them this week, or he's gone off with a new whatever it might be. It's constantly reactivating that trauma. And I think the big difference is, I can talk about Tristan till the cows come home. Lots of people who are divorced, it's almost like you feel you can't moan about it. You can't talk about how utterly difficult it is. And I think divorce, or people who are going through divorce and separation, it needs a lot more awareness of how unbelievably hideous it is on all parties involved. Because I do think it's a huge, huge, huge trauma.
Well, I think what I sort of take away from, you know, your honesty in it, is that actually the shared experience, and that's proof of why we're having this conversation, right, is there's value to be had in the shared experience, and somebody like yourself being as honest as you are about what it feels like. And I've never been through it. I can sympathise with it in terms of how tragic it is, but I've not been through it, so I don't have the same empathy that somebody who might be have gone through a similar thing. And actually, when you hear that, and that's my experience certainly of supporting dads with mental health, is that is so powerful to just hear somebody else and be like, A, I'm not on my own, B, that there is light at the end of the tunnel, be it in different guises, in different stages, And that just seeing that sense of hope and reality, being that somebody's a bit further down the line than me and actually they're still going and their kids are okay and they're, you know, they're surviving and they've found a way to cope with it, is so powerful. And actually it's fundamental to us being human, right, is that you need that shared experience. And I think
it's with so many things in life, and the word's a bit overused now, but it's about finding your tribe. You know, I've got the most gorgeous widowed friend who, weirdly, we were at school together. She was in the year below me. We were in the choir and the girl guys together, but I hadn't seen or thought about her since I left this particular school at about 15. And about 6 months after Tristan died, I got an email on Facebook and she said, I don't know if you remember me, but you know, we were at school together and my husband has just died. And we, you know, have been, you know, friends since that moment. And, you know, on a weekly basis, you know, she called me up this week and she said, I am just so lonely, you know, and she's same as me, 3-4 years in. I'm so unbelievably lonely. I can't imagine that anyone's ever going to love me like that again. I'm going to be on my own forever, la, 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 la. And, you know, most people looking outside go, oh, you know, they're doing okay, you know, la, la, la. And the reality is just so unbelievably different. You know, it's Father's Day coming up as well. It's just, you know, you would think, wouldn't you, Father's Day's in a couple of weeks, I've got quite a big family, you would think that one of them would have flagged it to say, what are you guys doing, should we come and cook you a roast, do you want to go out for dinner? Nothing, you know. And it's not, and the thing is as well, and why it's so important to find your tribe, is I thought there was something wrong with me. I thought I must be this horrible evil person that people don't want to come and help me and my family, but you go onto any of these grief groups and everyone is saying exactly the same thing. And it's utterly heartbreaking, you know, for people who are already in so much pain to just be forgotten about. And as I said, you know, I was talking with lots of my single mum friends the other day, and you never get invited anywhere anymore. Whether you're a widow or a single parent or a divorcee, you know, whether it's, you know, the women think they're going to, you're going to steal their husband or something ridiculous, but you don't get invited to things. And again, it's, you know, it is just gut-wrenching. And so my message that I would want people to take away from this is, you know, almost every week, you know, think about your friends and your people, you know, or the people you know at school, and just do a couple of random acts of kindness. You know, say, do you want to go for a drink on a Friday night? Do you want to play tennis on a Saturday? Do you want to, your kids want to come from a play day? Because, you know, the outward perceptions, I guarantee you, people look at me and go, she's fine, she's smashing it. And the messages I'll get, oh, you're so strong. I haven't got any option but to be strong. Yeah. I don't want to be strong. I'd much rather be an utter, you know, weakling, vulnerable mess and have Tristan here looking after me.
Yeah.
But they just presume, because they outwardly see you smiling occasionally and being okay, that you are okay. And, you know, really, it couldn't be further from the truth. So, you know, just look within your circle and think, you know, who could do with a little bit of extra TLC or a call this week? And it takes so little time, and it means so much to someone else, but so few people do it. You know, what am I going to do this weekend? What fun thing? Where am I going to go shopping? Where am I going to go to that nice party? And so few people actually think about others.
Yeah.
And
you don't ever know, do you, like what other people are going through? I think that's the one thing that I've learned in getting older, as you do, that you sort of, in wisdom, sort of come into that point of recognising the fact that, I think when I grew up, I kind of felt like, oh, why are they being like that with me? I've not done anything to justify that, making it all about me. When actually, as a grown-up now, I'm able to kind of see there could be a million reasons that they're doing what they're doing. And actually, I need to cut them some slack. It might be the reason that I used to think it was. And if it is, it's probably not going to hurt me. Well, but actually, to take the time to sort of ask and to find out is not a bad thing.
And you know what? I know that I'm doing such a good job with my boys, because someone cut me up the other day in the car and went, oh, wanker! And obviously, I swear far too much. And Indy went, Mummy, he might be having a really bad day. You just don't know what is happening in his life. Oh, my God. Oh, I was kind there of proud in equal measure.
Yeah. Kind of highlighting your own insecurities, think, cracky, how can I portray that to you, but yet be so obviously,
bless him. And it just made me laugh so much when they kind of repeat, you know, when you're not in that stressed, oh my God, I'm gonna die on the motorway type thing, moments, and you do have pearls of wisdom that sink into them sometimes.
You've got to test them. That's the way to look at it. You have to test their theory and make sure they're listening, because if they're not listening, then they would not be saying that. So that, I think that's a good case study. That's the way to look at it.
Bless them.
How, one last question, which I don't be how comfortable you are with, but how does the future feel for you in terms of, obviously you're still young relatively, and like in terms of new partners and those kind of things, how does that feel for
well,
you?
Well, I mean, the reality is, you know, I know that Tristan wouldn't want me to be on my own. But the reality is I have my boys every single day, 365 days a year. I haven't got anyone who, you know, will look after them. Also, they're not really comfortable going to other people. I can get the odd, you know, looking after, but any new relationship or any new partner is going to want to go away at the weekend. They're going to want to do all these things. So I've kind of written that off for now. Mm. But also, Indy said, if you get a new boyfriend, I will slit his throat.
Okay. So,
probably not the right time.
For everyone's safety, it's probably a good idea to wait. Exactly. Yeah.
And I also think because, I mean, Tristan was an amazing dad, but because we talk about him every day, almost like he's still here, I just think they think it would be like the ultimate
trial.
And also around us, you know, all of my friends are splitting up or having a or something. And I think they see all of this going on and go, well, it doesn't kind of end well when so-and-so gets a boyfriend, you know, that doesn't really generally work out. So, you know, I think, you know, that is, and to be honest, between the dog, the four cats, the two kids, the running the business, the Airbnb and trying a bit of self-care, there's no space for much.
No, for sure. I see that. I just, you know, I was just interested in from a point of view of other people that are going through a similar thing, how, you know, how it feels to kind of think about what that might look
well,
like and what it might.
Interesting is all of the stats, and again, this is in Julia Samuel's book. When it happens to men, they have remarried within 2 years. So when men are widowed with young children, they are remarried within 2 years of it happening, usually. I think it's something like 82%. Women tend to go one of two ways. They either meet someone very quickly or they don't meet anyone for ages. And I am definitely in that camp. And you know what? I've worked so hard to get our lives on an even keel and to get a good rhythm and to be okay with being on our own and all of that kind of stuff. You know, it's a incredibly high risk strategy to invite someone new to our vaguely safe bubble. And I'm quite philosophical, you know, if it's meant to happen, it will happen. You know, I'm definitely not going to go looking for it. But no, we're, I mean, it's taken almost 4 years, but we're in quite a good space now. And yeah, I don't want to risk.
Yeah, I completely understand that. Like in terms of, you know, you create this, you've learned to kind of create a new normal. And actually, why would you want to upset that apple cart and kind of go back to all the trauma that you've been through? And actually for your kids, like the protective nature for them must be huge in terms of making sure you don't upset that.
So we had an incident at the weekend and it just brought a tear to my eye. So one of my best friends, Sophie, she's got a lovely new partner called Lance, and we're all in Brighton, and he was just being so lovely with Ziggy, and you could just see that Ziggy needed that, wanted that. And so there's moments when that, and I go, oh god, maybe I should, you know. Indy is very anti it, but because Indy's the oldest, he's almost tried to adopt the role of Tristan, so he feels very protective. But you could just see how much joy, you know, even talk about it now, oh, it just makes me feel sick, you know, that Ziggy got from that relationship. So it's a really, really difficult one. I think if the person was right and the situation was right, then we would consider it. But yeah, I think that's going to be very, very, very difficult. And, you know, they might change and change their views. But at the moment, Indy is absolutely, it ain't happening, mate.
No, they come first, really.
But also, yeah, they 100% come first, 100%. And I'm quite, you know, unique in that. Lots of people, sadly, don't put their kids first. But, I mean, 100% they are first. But as I said, it's like musical beds. So there's a dog in my bed, you know, our Indy or Ziggy will swap in and swap out. So the idea of any new, I mean, I just don't know how the hell that would work.
No,
sleeping in the hammock in the garden.
not one for now, by the sound of things, by any stretch of the imagination.
But if Dave Grohl decided that he didn't want to be with his wife anymore, and I joke about this a lot and it drives the boys mad, I'd make an exception for Dave Grohl.
Well, now that's in the public domain, I imagine if they ever go through a divorce, then they'll be straight on the phone and be popping down to Teddington. Don't move, yeah, just in case. Yeah. Well, listen, it's been really lovely to have you. Thank you so much for your honesty and for being so real about kind of what it's been like for you, and for helping others, because I do genuinely believe that these conversations do change outcomes for other people. So thank you very much for coming on. It's been a real privilege to talk to you.
It's been a little bit heart-twingy, but it's been great to talk to you.
I don't know how, you know, when we first had this conversation about doing it, and obviously I sort of understood what you've been through, I said to my wife, I said, I don't know if I'll be able to hold it together, let alone. So I tip my hat to you. I think it's incredible. And as I say, for all the people that are listening to it, the value they'll get from it is really valuable. So thank you very much for your honesty. And it's been a pleasure. And I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
All right, Andy. Take care.
Thanks. Take care. Can't even begin to imagine what that must have felt like and still feel like today. And I think what Sarah has demonstrated there to me is the power of human resilience, the sheer strength of character she's got, and yet at the very same time the level of vulnerability to acknowledge the fact that of course you're never okay after something like that has happened. What you do is you learn to cope, and you learn to find a place for the grief that you've got to handle in that kind of situation. Of course, it's something that we hope never happens, but when it does, it's colossal. It's such a huge and significant thing. And how you cope with that, as how she's coped with that as a partner, as a parent, as a person, is nothing short of incredible to me. A huge thank you to her for coming on. It really has hopefully brought some light to a very difficult subject and opened the door to honest conversations. And I hope for those people listening, it's clearer how you can support people by asking what they need rather than dictating what they need. And at the same time, for those that are going through it themselves, there are others going through it as well, and you're not alone. Thank you so much to Sarah for coming on, and to all of you, please like and share specifically this one to those around to raise awareness for what we're going through here. Until next time.